Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Our topic today is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, good old MRSA, and the ways in which its epidemiology has shifted over the years. Joining me is Associate Professor John Ferguson, who is an infectious diseases specialist at John Hunter Hospital, and he's also a microbiologist at the University of Newcastle. My other guest is Dr. Jason Agostino, who is a lecturer in general practice at ANU. Both John and Jason are co-authors on some research, which is being published by the MJA on the 30th of October 2017, and will of course be open access at that time. You'll find it at mja.com.au. John, perhaps I might ask you, what was the purpose of this research? What were you trying to find out?
Well, the basic purpose was a descriptive epidemiology of Staph aureus infection in northern New South Wales. We were aware of increasing isolation of MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, from the community. And this needed to be documented. We needed to find out which subsections of the population were being affected more than others. And no one else had really done this in New South Wales. We had the availability.
Why is it important to figure out that? I mean, does it affect the way we go about our infection control procedures?
Well, it's the basic level of disease control to understand the epidemiology or the patterns of disease in the population, who's being affected more than others, and find out the risk factors for those that are identifying patients more likely to be affected. And that then potentially gives you the option of intervening to affect those risk factors.
Okay. Jason, perhaps could you tell us about the methodology and what data you used and why and how?
The Hunter New England Local Health District has a patient information management system that's called IPM. And essentially we got the IPM data and linked that to the pathology results that came from the main pathology provider for hospital services and also for general practitioners in the region from what's called Pathology North. So essentially we're getting those two data sets, putting them together and using that to answer these questions.
What were the big results that perhaps surprised you or confirmed what you were thinking?
Well, I guess there are a couple of things. One was the prevalence of community associated MRSA, colonisation and infection. In fact, a majority of the new isolates of MRSA were coming from the community, from patients that had no connection with healthcare. And I guess the second one was that prevalence had remained high for some time and was not actually increasing the way we thought it might be. It was holding steady at a relatively high rate. The third thing was that we successfully associated the presence of MRSA with certain intrinsic risk factors, such as being from an Indigenous group, being from an aged care facility, and being from a younger age group.
It's interesting to me that the results have highlighted the prevalence in both aged care homes and in younger people. Is there a connection between those things? What's the mechanism at work there, do we think?
Well, that's on the aged care facility side. I think this is complex. I think there's a lot of movement from hospitals into aged care and back. Infection control is very difficult to do well in an aged care setting. In fact, there are very few, if any, programs identifying that infection control works in aged care. Furthermore, antibiotic use is profligate in most aged care facilities, and that fuels transmission of things like MRSA. So it's in essence a perfect storm. You might have a resident coming from a hospital with MRSA colonisation, and they are able to share it around quite quickly because of that antibiotic exposure and the relative lack of infection control there in a susceptible group. and then there's the capacity for those residents to transfer it back to healthcare. In terms of younger patients, I think there's a different level of complexity there that we don't really understand. It may have to do with the sort of strains of MRSA. These community strains do not appear to prefer elderly patients as the older strains did. They seem to be able to transmit skin to skin and are often not colonising the nose. We know that Staph aureus is ubiquitous in infants and children, most of our carriers, and then they lose that carriage through teenage years. And it's apparent that MRSA is probably replacing, these strains of MRSA are probably replacing the existing endogenous strains of Staph aureus that are carried by young people. And this then leads to the situation where infections in those young people are more likely to be due to MRSA than methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus.
Jason, can you give us a few of the numbers in terms of prevalence and what percentage of MRSA is turning up in community-acquired situations rather than hospitals?
When we looked at the overall prevalence of MRSA, we found amongst Staph aureus, we could find that almost 20%, 19.3% of all first positive isolates were MRSA. And then when we focused on, if we looked at the group that hadn't been hospitalised past year, so that's what we're calling community-associated MRSA, it was the majority, 56.9% of all MRSA cases were community-associated. When we looked at the groups that were more likely to have community-associated MRSA, we found that, as you mentioned, younger people, so people under the age of 40, were more likely to have it, and residents of aged care facilities were likely to have it as well. And, amongst residents of aged care facilities, about one in three, episodes of Staph aureus were due to methicillin-resistant Staph aureus.
How has the epidemiology of MRSA changed over the years?
Back when I was at medical school, MRSA was something we thought about in hospitals. And, when I was going around in the wards, you'd hear about these people with these multi-resistant organisms sitting on the wards. And as I then moved out from the hospitals and into the general practicing, I work particularly in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, and I began seeing this MRSA out in young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who I hadn't that hadn't been in hospitals as far as I could tell. So, across Australia, there's been a few surveys now that have shown that we're isolating MRSA more and more in outpatients. And I guess what our study confirms is that, these people haven't been in hospital as far as we can tell, and that, there's this spread of MRSA within the community.
The other thing I was interested in is the seasonality of this. Why does it change with the seasons?
Well, no, this is something that's been described before. I'm not sure that anybody knows the true reason for this, but Jason will have a viewpoint, I'm sure. He's got experience with the data from Northern Territory.
I think it's unusual, and we couldn't explain it very well, but it is something that has been seen across the world in terms of we see a seasonal pattern across different regions of the world. So we're not the first study to show a seasonal pattern to MRSA in particular. Going to explain that cause is a little bit more difficult, but it's something that is showing up further the more we look into MRSA in the community setting.
John, what would you like to see happen now as a result of these findings and other similar findings? What do you think needs to happen in terms of the way we go about our infection control and surveillance?
Yeah, so look, I think surveillance is the number one. We need to know what is going on in the community. We need to know which sections of the community are more affected, because they then become the focus of control efforts. The second thing, I think, is in front of infection control is probably antibiotic stewardship. So antibiotic use in the community is clearly fueling transmission and susceptibility. And really, the same approach to stewardship has to happen that's happening in hospitals, and we need that stewardship in aged care facilities more than anything. The third thing is infection control, and that can be focused on groups that are experiencing outbreaks. So this might be institutional outbreaks or outbreaks within a community, teaching basic hygiene, hand washing, etc. You know, hospital infection control is very tricky to do in a community setting, but there are basic concepts around hygienic measures around dressings, washing of hands, and in terms of household conditions as well.
Most hospitals now seem to have you walk in the door and there's a hand sanitisation centre. Every ward has them at the start and finish of each ward. Do GPs need to start doing those kind of things?
Certainly. So, of course, MRSA will be colonising a range of clients at the GP surgery. They'll be contaminating the environment,
yes,
and potentially cross-transmitting to other patients. So there's sort of public environments, even sporting facilities, sporting teams can fuel transmission. I think we know that improving hand hygiene in the community is well associated with declining rates of gastroenteritis, for instance. The impact on staff transmission is less well documented, though. And so I guess these sort of interventions need to be studied in a proper way in those risk groups, and we need to work out what works.
It's quite clear that Australia prescribes a lot of antibiotics. You know, we did the Atlas of Healthcare Variation, you know, highlighted we're one of the top prescribers of antibiotics per capita in the world, and, you know, made recommendations that we do take steps to change that. And I think this is another piece of evidence to suggest that we do need to take some steps to look at antibiotic prescribing in our community. John probably also talked about, you know, we need to get better at what we're doing in terms of surveillance. You know, this type of study at the moment is really only possible in the Hunter New England area, as far as I'm aware. But it would be great to have these type of data available more widespread across Australia and in a more, you know, rapid fashion. You know, the patterns of antibiotic resistance change really quickly in this study, you know. Over a 7-year period, you know, what was there at the start and what there was at the end was really different. And, you know, glad we were looking at it. But, you know, you sort of shudder at the thought of what's sort of being stored in terms of data not analysed and not analysed in a good way. So, you know, things that we can do to use all this data that we're health data that we're storing and actually use it to improve health service delivery would be a really good thing.
Yeah, so one of the other interesting aspects is that the sorts of MRSA that are circulating in the community quite distinct from those, say, circulating in aged care facilities and healthcare. So in the latter, the UK EMRSA15-like strain has become prevalent in aged care and hospitals. It sort of replaced the older multi-resistant strain. And that strain's has a tendency to cause infections in older people and has an association with institutions, etc. Whereas the major strain circulating in the community in concert with other parts of Australia are these non-multi-resistant strains that would be carrying the PVL toxin and are associated with boils and sometimes with severe septicemic infection and pneumonia. So there are two different epidemics occurring, if you like. But it does underpin the need for different approaches in the community to those in hospitals to some degree. We're seeing a different epidemiology, and that then naturally leads to a different focus in control efforts, albeit that some things are in common, like antibiotic stewardship and hygiene, etc.
You know, this is one of a number of studies now that have shown a high prevalence of MRSA in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And you know, I think while our paper talks about better targeting antibiotic therapy to these groups, and perhaps, you know, points recent studies that shown that Bactrim is effective against both strep and staph, including MRSA. And I think that's an important step. But it's also, I think, you know, important to think about the social determinants that have led to that have probably contributed to this high amount of people with MRSA, you know, these overcrowded houses with, you know, where transmission of disease is much more frequent. So, you know, we still know that, you know, across Australia, around 1 in 5 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are living in overcrowded housing. And while we've talked about antibiotic strategies, I think we also need to think more broadly about housing strategies to help address multiple infections, of which MRSA is just one.
Thank you both for your time.
Thanks, Kate.
Okay, thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.